Okay, the first section we're going to read from is from the book The Great Conspiracy, The Secret War Against Soviet Russia by Michael Sayers and Albert E. Kahn, first published Little Brown and Company in Boston in 1946. Okay, we're reading from a footnote, and it's a long footnote, though, don't get me wrong. Reads as follows. In January 1941, when the German High Command was completing its preparations for the attack on the Soviet Union, a sensational anti-Soviet book was published in the United States entitled Out of the Night. The author's name was given as Jan Valtin. Jan Valtin was one of the several aliases of Richard Krebs, a former Gestapo agent. His other aliases were Richard Anderson, Richard Peterson, Richard Williams, Rudolf Heller, and Otto Melchior. Krebs' book, Out of the Night, purported to be the confession of a communist, Jan Valtin, who had been traveling about the world carrying out sinister assignments for Moscow. The author described in lurid detail the criminal conspiracies which had supposedly been engineered by, quote, Bolshevik agents against world democracy. The author related how after 10 years of criminal service, quote, for the Comintern, including an attempted murder in California in 1926, he had begun to have, quote, doubts in the desirability and the purpose of the Communist Party. Finally, so his story went, he had decided to make a complete break with Moscow and tell all. Krebs arrived in the United States in February 1938. He brought with him from Europe the manuscript of Out of the Night, which bore a startling resemblance to an anti-Soviet propaganda book which was being currently circulated in Nazi Germany. In preparing the book for publication in the United States, Krebs was assisted by the American journalist Isaac Don Levine, a veteran anti-Soviet propagandist and a regular contributor to the Hearst Press.
Now recall, in Radio Free America number 1, we took a look at the overtly pro-fascist sympathies of the Hearst Press and some of the front-page columns by such champions of freedom as Hermann Göring, Benito Mussolini, and Alfred Rosenberg.
That's right. Aided by an unprecedented promotional campaign, and bear in mind, this is only a few months before the bombing attack on Pearl Harbor at this point. We are not yet in the war with Germany or Japan, and there is still hope in the hearts of the dyed-in-the-wool fascists in the United States that we can be kept out of the war with Germany until Britain can be conquered by the Germans, and then hopefully America would sue for peace at a status quo. Aided by an unprecedented promotional campaign, Out of the Night became a sensational bestseller. The Book of the Month Club distributed 165,000 copies among its readers. Reader's Digest published a lengthy condensation with a comment that the autobiography had been, quote, carefully authenticated by the publishers. In two consecutive issues, Life magazine quoted extensive sections from the book. Few books in the history of American publishing received the promotional ballyhoo and expensive advertising lavished on Out of the Night. While a number of book reviewers were openly skeptical about the book, others, well known for their anti-Soviet sentiments, showered praises on Krebs' work. Frieda Utley, anti-Soviet newspaper woman writing in the Saturday Review of Literature, described the book in these words, quote, no other book more clearly reveals the aid which Stalin gave to Hitler before he won power, and which he must be giving him today. Bear in mind, this is just before the Soviet Union is about to be attacked by the Nazis. Sidney Hook, an admirer of Trotsky, declared in the New Leader, organ of the so-called Social Democratic Federation, quote, as a sheer story, it is so compelling in its breathtaking sequences that it could never be accepted as fiction, for it violates all the canons of fictional credibility. William Henry Chamberlain, whose anti-Soviet interpretation of the Moscow trials had appeared in the Tokyo propaganda organ Contemporary Japan, urged in the New York Sunday Times book supplement that, quote, Valtin become, quote, a valuable assistant to those United States agencies which are engaged in combating espionage, sabotage, and other illegal foreign-inspired activities. Max Eastman, Eugene Lyons, and others of the anti-Soviet pro-Trotsky literary clique in America excitedly hailed the, quote, historic exposé by the former Gestapo agent. Jan Valtin became a national figure. He was invited to testify as an anti-Soviet expert before the Dies Committee. Bear in mind, Jan Valtin is a fictional character invented by a Gestapo agent. On March 28, 1941, Krebs was served with a warrant of arrest as an undesirable and deportable alien. The subsequent federal hearings established that Krebs had been found guilty of attempted murder in California in 1926 and had served 39 months in San Quentin. The Los Angeles court records showed that this crime, which Krebs had portrayed in Out of the Night as a Comintern assignment, had resulted from an argument over a bill which Krebs owed a small merchant. Explaining in court why he had tried to kill the merchant, Krebs said, quote, "The Jew made me mad," unquote. The federal hearings also revealed that Krebs had been deported from the United States in December 1929 and that in 1938, as in 1926, he had entered the United States illegally. In addition, the hearings established that in 1934, Krebs had acted as a witness for the Nazi government in securing a treason conviction against a fellow seaman. As for his connection with the German Communist Party, from which he had been expelled, Krebs admitted that he had, quote, penetrated the organization. The U.S. Immigration Court stated in its findings, quote, "Within the past 5 years, the subject has been considered an agent of Nazi Germany. On the record before us, it appears he has been completely untrustworthy and amoral." The exposure of Krebs as a former Nazi agent and convicted criminal received little publicity. Later, endorsed and vouched for by his influential anti-Soviet American friends, Krebs was given a clear bill of health by U.S. immigration authorities as a reformed individual and was granted American citizenship papers. Out of the Night remained on public library bookshelves throughout the country and continued to spread its anti-Soviet message among tens of thousands of Americans. And remember, bear in mind that the man who helped him put that book together was Isaac Don Levine.
Okay, and remember also the similarity between the obviously spurious and Gestapo-generated story of Krebs, alias Valtin, and the Bogdan Stashinsky story, whether that was absolutely true or not. There are obviously some fairly serious doubts about it. But notice the similarity between the two techniques and the two incidents, and also that Isaac Don Levine is a connecting link here. Isaac Don Levine, who ghostwrites the book for Anna Kasenkina, he works with Krebs on Out of the Night, allegedly by Jan Valtin. He also is going to write a book with Marina Oswald, okay? Now, at roughly the same time period where, Isaac Don Levine of the Hearst Press, the pro-fascist Hearst Press, is working with Gestapo agent Richard Krebs on this anti-Soviet forgery, this is during the same time period when Isaac Don Levine was playing a key role in another very, very important American political case. And keep in mind his role here with the Kennedy assassination and Marina's biography. Now, Isaac Don Levine was the man who took Whitaker Chambers, again, supposedly a former KGB agent or NKVD agent, I guess it would have been at that point, and persuaded Whitaker Chambers to break the story about Alger Hiss's alleged connections to the Communist Party. And, of course, recall now that Whitaker Chambers kept a life-size picture of Hitler over his fireplace, as we looked at in Radio Free America either one or two. I guess that was in number two. And recall also that Alger Hiss had been special counsel to the Nye Committee, which had been investigating American industrialists and munition makers' assistance to the Axis cause. Now, it was Isaac Don Levine who persuaded Whitaker Chambers to talk to a U.S. State Department employee named Adolf Burley. Burley was the fellow who eventually spilled the beans, and of course, one Richard Milhouse Nixon was the ultimate beneficiary, the greatest single beneficiary of the Alger Hiss case. That sort of made his congressional career. And recall now that in 1939 is when Isaac Don Levine arranges for Whitaker Chambers to meet with Adolf Burley, and that was to result in the case against Alger Hiss. Of course, recall also that as we looked at in Guns of November number 3, Richard Nixon was in Dallas, Texas on November 22nd, 1963, lied about it. 3 months later to the FBI, he said he'd left 2 days before, okay? Reading now from a book about the Hiss-Kenwood Chambers case called Friendship and Fratricide. It was published by the Viking Press of New York in hardcover, copyright 1967. With regard to Isaac Don Levine and his eventual arranging of Whitaker Chambers' meeting with Adolf Burley, Zelig writes, "Both Herbert Salau and Isaac Don Levine were intimately connected with the events that led to Chambers' conversation with Burley, and I am indebted to them for their informative help in this area. It was to Salau, a former Columbia classmate and a journalist, that Chambers first went with his combined confession and expose. Quote, Chambers sought me out, told me that he was breaking with the party and had a manuscript he wanted me to market for him. It was always an ambiguous matter with Chambers, i.e. about his communist activities. Had I been asked to prove that he was engaged in underground activities, I would have been unable to do so. Either he was engaged in underground activities or he wished he was. He needed help, and he wanted me to arrange a meeting with the President of the United States in order to make a deal with the President in which he would reveal secret information of a very important nature, the possession of which could get him in trouble, in exchange for which he wanted immunity. I did not know President Roosevelt, but felt I must do what I can, unquote. I made several abortive efforts to contact people who might lead toward the White House. I hit upon Isaac Don Levine, who was then a well-known journalist, a strong person who did not just toy with ultra-rightism. That interjecting is obviously the case. I felt that Mr. Levine was savvy and would not blunder. I arranged the meeting with Isaac Don Levine. Now, keep in mind, this is 1939. 41 was when he's working with Richard Krebs. Isaac Don Levine, that is. Okay, it's still later in Friendship and Fratricide. But it seems more than talking about Chambers' attempt to get a meeting with Roosevelt. But it seems more than plausible that this was a bluff, and that he knew that the chances of a meeting with the President were slight. Levine emphasized that Chambers' main concern was for his own safety. Chambers wanted reassurance that he would not be indicted. Levine did not arrange a meeting with Roosevelt, but he did contact Assistant Secretary of State Burley, then Chief Security Officer for the State Department. Having earlier committed himself to Levine in his need to sell a story at a time when he was destitute and in flight, Chambers had no recourse but to continue. In September of 1939, Levine took a reluctant Chambers, as Levine described it, by the arm to the home of Burley. Had it not been for Levine's insistence, which included his own journalistic aspirations for a sensational scoop, one can only speculate whether Chambers might ever have told his story as he did. Well, of course, as Peter Dale Scott indicated in the last sentence of the Dallas Conspiracy that we read before getting to the Great Conspiracy and Friendship and Fratricide, with regard to trying to develop a Russian conspiracy concept, that was old hat for Isaac Don Levine. And keep in mind, in the same time period in which he's arranging for Whitaker Chambers' alleged confession, he's also working with Gestapo agent Richard Krebs, and Krebs, of course, an alleged communist terrorist, similar to Bogdan Stashinsky, who may have been, but there are some interesting discrepancies in Bogdan Stashinsky's story, the purported murder of Stefan Bandera.
Okay, back to the Russian circle surrounding Lee Harvey Oswald. Bear in mind here that the larger concept that we're being asked to believe is that all of these Russians, white Russians, anti-communist Russians, many of whom had fled Russia specifically because of their hatred of the communists, that these people, all of them employed in the defense and the petroleum industry, just decided that because Marina Oswald spoke Russian and because Lee Harvey Oswald had been in Russia, that they would adopt this couple as near and dear to their hearts and go out of their way to give them presents, take them places and things.
Oswald, who had supposedly defected to the Soviet Union with top secret information about our radar nets.
That's right, and had been getting into fights in public with anti-Castro Cubans, and basically was purporting himself to be a Marxist. Now, contrast this to some actual situations, for instance, down in Southern California, where there is an anti-communist Vietnamese community, and in which just recently a few people have been shot and killed for not being rigorously anti-communist enough. Compare that to the friendliness and light that seems to be emanating from the Russian, white Russian community in Dallas surrounding Lee Harvey Oswald, the Marxist defector. Reading again from Peter Dale Scott's monograph, the real patron of the Dallas Russian community was the Dallas oil millionaire Paul Rygorodsky, a director of the Tolstoy Foundation, who had also performed other confidential missions for the U.S. government in Europe. Again, just to remind you, okay, not only this guy is a Dallas oil millionaire, he is a director of the Tolstoy Foundation, which has been bringing in people after thoroughly checking to make sure they don't have any leftist sympathies before they will bring Russians into their communities.
In partnership with the CIA.
In partnership with the CIA, and all of a sudden this guy is going to be is the godfather of this Russian community that's taken Oswald, the Marxist defector, to heart. George Bowie testified before the commission that while Rygorodsky was the, quote, godfather of the group, he himself, meaning Bowie, did the organization work. Others testified that he, quote, even kept files on new arrivals. From the fact that all members of the Russian community were, quote, well acquainted with each other, unquote, commission counsel Jenner elicited testimony that it was, quote, perfectly normal for the community to have lavished such care on the Oswalds. Nevertheless, from April to November 1963, the Russian community severed all contact with the Oswalds, even when Marina was separated and more helpless than before, and their babysitting role was now temporarily assumed by the Russian-speaking American Ruth Payne, a Quaker. Ruth Payne had her own contacts with the Russian community, but had, quote, accidentally met the Oswalds through one Russian she did not know, Count de Morenschild, who we spoke about earlier, who had been accused of spying for the Germans during World War II. Before April, the avowed Marxist Oswald was cared for by the, quote, old guard Russians. These were mostly aristocratic and united in their nostalgia for the Ancien Régime, the old guard, in contrast to the more recent and plebeian post-war émigrés. Differences between these two emigrations produced two separate Russian parishes in Dallas during the 1950s, each claiming to be more anti-communist than the other, but divided on the issue of what to do about the liberation of Russia. To judge from their testimony, the old guard, even if czarist in their nostalgia, echoed the policies of the American CIA establishment of which they were indeed part. The new arrivals included Ukrainians and other non-Russian Soviet minorities. And some of them, although less aristocratic, were ideologically more right-wing and revanchist. Again, bear in mind, we're talking about Ukrainians. Some of the Ukrainians could very well have been the OUN Bandera that we were talking about earlier. At least two of the new arrivals were far to the right of de Morenschild, whom one of them described in one breath as a, quote, leftist and as, quote, an Eisenhower Republican.
That sentence, I think, is worth, in order to get an idea of how, just how venal these people were, that sentence, I think, is worth repeating here.
Yes.
And the man referred to here is a former Nazi spy.
That's right. Referred to by one of these newcomers, these right-wing, further right-wing revanchists, de Morenschild is referred to by one of them in one breath as, quote, a leftist and an Eisenhower Republican. Unlike all the other Russians investigated by the commission, these two men, Ilya Mamontov and Igor Voshinin, are said to have made a point of never meeting the Oswalds before the assassination. Yet it was their circle, rather than the old guard, which adopted Marina thereafter. The two Russians who did not meet Oswald are even more interesting than the rest who did. Igor Voshinin was a member of a worldwide Russian organization called the NTS, in English usually called either the National Alliance of Solidarists or the National Toilers Alliance, Toilers, T-O-I-L-E-R-S, a semi-covert organization working closely with revanchist elements in West Germany, with the APACL, remember that's the Asian People's Anti-Communist League, and the Kuomintang in Taiwan, and at one time, until the pro-Ukrainian ABN drove them out, with the Latin American CIADC, which is another anti-communist congress in Latin America, and their proposed World Anti-Communist Conference for Freedom and Liberation.
So again, the NTS, the Solidarists, an organization which, during this formative period of WACL, worked very closely with the various WACL elements which are gathering here. A very important thing to note here, because this is a WACL-affiliated element.
Okay, continuing. There is little recent research on the NTS. They are known to have been founded in 1930 by a group of émigrés, nearly all engineers, in Belgrade. Many of the Russians who came to Texas after World War II had lived in Serbia, including Voshinin himself, an engineer. During the war, many of the NTS collaborated with the Nazis, and particularly the Nazi Leibrandt, in Rosenberg's Ostministerium, who accepted the Solidarists because of, quote, their ideological proximity to fascism. As such, they ran a, quote, training camp for the Nazis at Wustrau, and later supplied the right wing of the Russian forces grouped briefly by Himmler under the turncoat Russian general Vlasov.
And, of course, grouped under Himmler also was Galen, under whom the Vlasov army was assembled, and with the person who actually helped formally surrender the Vlasov army was Theodor Oberlander, another key Galen aide who worked with the ABN and who figures prominently in Dallas, again with Bunker Hunt. We looked at him in Radio Free America 14.
After the war, the NTS, unlike the other Vlasovites, now called the SBONR, finally refused an American invitation to participate in the activities of the American Committee for the Liberation of the Peoples of Russia. As under the Nazis, the great Russian and neo-Slavophile Solidarists refused to have anything to do with any policy which encouraged the hopes of Ukrainians and other minorities for ultimate independence. Yet the NTS continued, despite its illiberal ideology, to have a good press in the United States. In particular, its elitist strategy that one should appeal not to dissident minorities like the Ukrainians, but rather to the cadres of the Russian army and bureaucracy, was echoed, not only in Taiwan, where the same strategy has been advocated for China, but also among highly placed American, quote, liberation experts. One such expert, who criticized the presence of separatists in the U.S.-sponsored Radio Liberation in Munich, was Isaac Don Levine.
The same Isaac Don Levine who was going to help write Marina's book, who did help write Richard Krebs' book, alias Jan Valtin, and who persuaded Whitaker Chambers to, quote, confess, unquote. Hang on just one second here. Okay. Of particular interest to the story of Marina Oswald are the repeated stories that the NTS have succeeded in planting agents inside the Soviet Union, particularly in the Army, a fact which may or may not have something to do with the known penetration of Soviet Army intelligence, the GRU, by the CIA. The NTS, along with its Ukrainian enemies in the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, also collaborated closely with the efforts of the APA, the Asian People's Anti-Communist League in Taipei, where the NTS maintains permanent representation, to establish the proposed World Anti-Communist Conference for Freedom and Liberation, that is, until the NTS was excluded by a coalition between Catholic Ukrainians and anti-communists from Latin America. During the Hungarian uprising of 1956, for example, the APACL's message of support was transmitted to Hungary via the services of the NTS Radio Free Russia. This makes it likely that the NTS was also in contact in Texas with the allies of the APACL and through them with the John Birch Society and the supporters of General Walker. Of course, that whole group we looked at in Radio Free America's number, well, the Aryan Nation series. Neither Bushinin, that's Igor Bushinin, nor his friend Ilya Mamontov was asked whether he belonged to the NTS. Mamontov spontaneously denied being a member of the John Birch Society even before de Morenschild had suggested that he was, while singling him out rather than Bushinin as the one excessive rightist of the Russian community. He was, however, a geologist with the Sun Oil Company, whose owners, the Pugh family, have in the last few years given well over $1 million to right-wing organizations such as the Christian Freedom Foundation. Recall also that in Radio Free America numbers 11 and 12, we took a look at the Pugh family and a person who worked for them, a former, I've forgotten his name offhand. He was a former Luftwaffe agent, Hans Senholz, that was his name, who was a key propagandist and writer for the Pugh family and the organizations they supported. And Hans Senholz, a figure who also coalesces with the Aryan Nations, part of which, of course, embraces this whole group here. That is to say, the American branch. The excessive rightist Mamontov, who never met Oswald, was, however, the one Russian who personally knew the alleged liberal Ruth Payne, apart from his mother-in-law, who was her tutor. And it was Mamontov who was the first Russian to renew the community's contact with Marina some 5 hours after the assassination. He had been called by telephone to serve as interpreter at the first questioning of Marina in the presence of their mutual friend, Ruth Payne. It was not, however, Ruth Payne who had first contacted him to interpret, but Mr. Jack Crichton, C-H-R-I-C-H-T-O-N, unquote, a petroleum engineer, a petroleum operator connected with the Army Reserve Intelligence Service. Okay, and recall also Lev Dobryansky's connections with Army Intelligence Reserve and a proposed military government. Recall also Ed Meese, a high-ranking Army Reserve officer. He was the fellow who handled the Edgar Eugene Bradley situation for then-governor, now president, of course, Ronald Reagan. And the Dallas conspiracy here involves some very, very weighty discussion of comparing the way in which Peter Gregory and Ilya Mamontov handled the interviews of Marina. Marina spoke no English, although she understood more than she let on. And Peter Dale Scott has done a magnificent piece of research in comparing various accounts of this and showing how these both Mamontov and Peter Gregory deliberately mistranslated what Marina was saying. And in particular, they led Marina's interrogation in such a way as to make Marina talk about the rifle being very dark and dark in color, because that was the one detail that the Warren Commission was able to use eventually to indicate, to corroborate that Marina had indeed seen the rifle that that Lee Harvey Oswald supposedly had. Now, the thing is that we're not actually going to read the comparisons of the testimony here for the simple reason that it's extremely detailed, very weighty, and, well, recalling the discussion on Guns of November number 3, Scott's discussion of the Vietnam War and the Kennedy assassination, this discussion would be, that's light by comparison. So rather than going through a long, complicated discussion, Scott's scholarship is excellent. The points he makes are very, very fine, but we're not going to read the actual discussion here, partly to time limitations and also to the fact that it would make for a really dizzying account. But that is the essence of how Peter Gregory and Mamontov distorted Marina's testimony, and Nip's going to read you more about that now.
Okay. continuing in Peter Dale Scott's monograph, and as Dave said, skipping the entire testimony of Marina's conversations with the interviewers and interrogators.
What Scott does is he actually has it line by line, and he compares what they said with the actual translation as provided by a subsequent FBI interpreter, and it's very, very tortuous and probably wouldn't be that meaningful on radio anyway.
This indication of a conspiracy between Marina and Gregory should have made the commission curious about all of Gregory's suppressions and gratuitous additions, even the apparently innocuous interpolation that the rifle was, quote, dark. The darkness of the Carcano stock, that's the Mannlicher Carcano, was the rifle that supposedly was used by Oswald in the assassination. The darkness of the Carcano stock, testified to by other witnesses such as Detective Weitzman, was in fact one of only two details about the rifle allegedly mentioned by Marina in her interview with the Dallas police 2 days earlier, when the interpreter was Ilya Mamontov. The second detail was the fact, in contradiction to the report, the Warren report, but in agreement with Gregory, that she, quote, never have seen gun with a telescopic sight. On Saturday, Marina was interviewed a second time through Ruth Payne and Ilya Mamontov, this time by the FBI. As on Friday and Sunday, she was reported to have again said the rifle, quote, was a dark color like the one she had seen, but she did not recall the sight. It would appear that on Friday, the Dallas police had repeatedly questioned Marina through Mamontov about the gun's, quote, dark brown black color, a phrase which Mamontov repeats four times in his testimony to the commission. For Marina's recognition of this color was the only evidence that she had recognized the rifle when she partially unrolled the blanket in the Payne's garage. How then on Sunday could Mr. Gregory have added this small but allegedly important detail lacking in Marina's testimony unless someone had already told him about it? There are other indications of illicit links between Gregory and the FBI's, quote, investigation of Oswald. For example, Gregory's affidavit certifying to Oswald's fluency in Russian, which he had signed on personalized stationery. It had apparently been trimmed of its signature and letterhead between its receipt by the FBI and its receipt by the commission. In other words, they clipped Gregory's name off of this before it got to the commission. Without suggesting that any role in the assassination was played by the Dallas-Fort Worth Russian community as a whole or in part, it is clear that some of its members played a dominant role in defining the alleged links between it and the Oswald family. This was true both before the assassination, when they determined the Oswald's social contacts, and after it, when they controlled and altered the quote, information supplied about Lee by Marina. That Mamontov and Gregory were put in this position to exercise such control is inexcusable, even assuming that Oswald was an agent.
Okay, well, basically, we're going to take a break now, and then we're going to come back, sum up some things, and then we're going to talk about the assassination of Swedish Premier Olof Palme, and that'll wind up our program for this evening.
All right, so just a few more minutes from the involvement of the World Anti-Communist League all night tonight in various operations, including the death squads in Latin America, as originally sponsored by the CIA, and through its Eastern European branches, many of which are still quite active. Today, we mentioned, of course, the OUN Bandera at some length. Lev Dobryansky, tied to the OUN Bandera, was just recently Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas, and he is working with people like Patrick Buchanan in their attack on those who want to have war criminals deported from this country. We talked about the involvement of these groups in the Kennedy assassination and in the once-and-for-all trashing of any attempts to alleviate the Cold War by John F. Kennedy, eventually resulting in the final and ultimate trashing of John F. Kennedy's political mandate, his own assassination in November of 1963 in Dallas.
Also, now, remember the pattern that we looked at in connection with both the Kennedy and Bandera assassinations, which the same WACL elements which were involved in the steering committee, which resulted in WACL, were attempting to link, okay? And we also saw about the connection between Wesley Liebler, who handled the interrogations of all of the Russians for the Warren Commission, and Frank Wisner's law firm, the same Frank Wisner of the Office of Policy Coordination and the CIA, who helped bring Bandera and his old organization into the U.S. and into the U.S. national security establishment to begin with. Because we're going to take a look now at the assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, and we're going to see a remarkably unnerving similarity between this recent assassination and the patterns that we've seen developing in connection with Bandera, the efforts of Isaac Non-Levine to portray Richard Krebs as a Soviet agent, his work with Whitaker Chambers and so forth, and of course later Isaac Non-Levine turns up along with Marina Oswald. reading about the assassination of Olaf Palme. This from the San Jose Mercury of Saturday, March 1st, 1986. The story is headlined, Prime Minister of Sweden slain while strolling. It's Dateline Stockholm, Sweden from the Mercury Wire Services. Prime Minister Olaf Palme was shot down on a snowy sidewalk Friday night as he walked with his wife in downtown Stockholm. He was pronounced dead at a hospital early this morning. Police, searching for one gunman, sealed off the city and ordered through checks at the airport and ordered thorough checks at the airport and other exits from the country. Sweden's TT, National News Agency, quoted police as saying an unidentified man had been detained outside the Prime Minister's office for questioning about the slaying at 6 a.m. today. TT quoted an unidentified police source as saying, "We want to question him because his description concurs with that of a man seen on the spot of the crime," unquote. There was no immediate indication whether the man held was the gunman. Earlier, police had questioned about 10 people on the street where the 59-year-old leader was slain. According to TT, police suspected the exile Croatian terror organization Ustasha as possibly being behind the killing. The agency said the police had pulled out a nationwide bulletin naming the group. Stockholm Police Headquarters, however, declined to comment on the report. Croatia is part of Yugoslavia, with Croatians representing one of the largest ethnic groups in the communist-ruled Balkan country. A Croatian separatist, Miro Barisic, B-A-R-E-S-I-C, is jailed in Sweden for the April 7, 1971 assassination of Vladimir Rolovic, R-O-L-O-V-I-C, then Yugoslavia's ambassador to Sweden. The government has commuted Barisic's sentence and planned to release him in about 2 years. Now, the Ustashi are basically another one of these revanchist East European groups, one of the groups allied with the anti-Comintern. They were explicitly fascist. Nip's going to tell you a little bit about him, and then he's going to bring the assassination of the Yugoslavian ambassador to Sweden and the Ustashi, the possible Ustashi connection to the Olaf Palme assassination, into greater focus.
Again, as Dave said, this is a, a fairly common syndrome that we saw during World War II, which was that the rolling pressure of the Nazis through Europe and through most of what we now call Eastern Europe, although it certainly happened in Western Europe as well, brought up in their wake these native fascist organizations, most of them extremely anti-Semitic and extremely violent and pro-fascist, and in essence Nazi organizations themselves, brought them to the surface, and in many cases they were installed, at least briefly for a while, as governments of these various countries. And this has been, most of them, their only legal claim to legitimacy post-World War II, is their brief periods of time when they were governments in alliance with Nazi Germany. This is the case of the Ustashi, who came to power briefly in Yugoslavia during World War II, and from the moment that they took power, waged a hellish war of persecution on their Serbian counterparts. The Ustashi were primarily a Croatian group. The Serbs and the Croatians have been linked together by a chain of mutual dislike, mutual hatred for many, many years. Of course, it was the Serbian conflict that started off World War I in the first place. This goes back many, many years. During World War II, as mentioned, the Ustashi, a Croatian fascist organization, rose to power in Yugoslavia until, of course, the Red Army pushed the Nazis and their followers back out. Now, to this day, of course, the Ustashi still maintain that they have some legitimacy as spokesmen for the Croatian people, and of course there are most of the Croatian, most, not all of course, but most of the Croatians in this country, from my readings anyway, tend to support this strongly anti-communist, although probably not necessarily all of them, by any means, pro-violent approach to this sort of revanchist theory. One of the current cases is the Artukovich case, which has just recently been concluded by Artukovich being deported. Andrija Artukovich was another Ustashi SS man.
Well, what he was the Croatian Minister of the Interior. His nickname, and it's altogether appropriate, is the Himmler of the Balkans. He supervised the setting up of the Ustashi concentration camps, in which they exterminated not only Serbs but Jews and Gypsies. The most notorious of them being the Jasenovac camp, which was a converted brickyard. And what they did was they simply kept the kilns in, and they would herd their victims inside and fire up the kilns and burn them alive. They were also noted, the Ustashi were, for having throat-cutting contests. Each Ustasha carried a curved knife called a graviso, and they used to have throat-cutting contests at Jasenovac. The winner, whose name I can't recall, cut 1,500 throats in a single evening, and I guess he then held the new world's indoor throat-cutting record. But it's also worth noting that the Ustashi were very closely affiliated with the Vatican. A member of their congress was Archbishop Stepanak.
That's right. Now, several things going on here. First of all, now, Artukovich, the man mentioned, who was the minister who had direct connections to the Nazis, and as Dave mentioned, to the camp at Jasenovac, and these other various and sundry unpleasant activities, in the course of various people in the United States finally trying to have him deported after having lived in the United States for some 40 years, he made alliance with the Reagan White House. And this is one of the cases where Pat Buchanan went out, Reagan's director, White House director of communications, went out and began calling the people who were trying to get Artukovich, this man, again, responsible for pogroms in which thousands and thousands of Jews and Serbs and Gypsies were killed. Pat Buchanan, on behalf of Ronald Reagan, went around calling the people trying to get rid of Artukovich communist dupes. This is, again, the kind of political mindset we have in the current administration. Stepanach is another, and I believe there was recently a big deal with Stepanach's gravesite, if I am correct.
Pope wanted to say a mass at Stepanach's grave, and that did not sit well with the Yugoslavian authorities.
Yes, needless to say, because, of course, most of the people in power today in Yugoslavia were in some shape or form themselves in danger of their lives the whole time that the Ustashi were in power, and many of them, in fact, were fought with the Red Army to throw the Ustashi out.
What really happened is there was a fierce guerrilla warfare in Yugoslavia, and the partisans eventually, they kept a lot of Nazi troops pinned down, and eventually, they, with the Red Army assistance, they came to power in Yugoslavia. So the people in power there now were the victims of the Croatians.
Absolutely. Okay, so anyway, that being the case, and given this now, the Ustashi still, again, as we said, being an organization that, even though most of them now are probably second generation, still very much an organization that is involved in politics. We just mentioned the Pat Buchanan connection.
In one of the first articles we read in our first Wackle show, it was a long article from the Village Voice of December of 19, I guess actually October or November of 1985, there was discussion of residual Ustashi and Croatian links to Wackle, and we're going to explore some more of those right now.
Okay, reading again from the book we started off with tonight, The Great Heroin Coup by Henrik Krüger. In a footnote near the back of the book, Krüger writes as follows. Stein also reports rumors of an alliance of Stein, and by the way, is a reporter for the Village Voice, I believe.
Jeff Stein.
Also reports rumors of an alliance of anti-communist terrorist groups involving the Croatians, in particular, whose bombing activities have recently been on the rise. Bear in mind, this is written in 1980. Its funding, according to FBI sources, is coming from Paraguay, and that Nazi haven's recent arrival from Nicaragua, Anastasio Somoza. Yugoslavia recently requested a U.S. crackdown on the Croatian National Congress headed by Janko Skrabin, whose extradition as a war criminal the Yugoslavs seek for his collaboration with the Germans in a, quote, independent fascist state of Croatia from 1941 to 1945. These allegations are particularly interesting in light of the revelations in Latin America Political Report that the Croatian representative of the World Anti-Communist League in Paraguay, Dinko Zakic, had used $3.5 million from the WACL's regional organization, the Confederación Anticomunista Latinoamericana, CAL, which we've talked about quite a bit tonight, to finance Croatian terrorist activities. These included the murders of the Uruguayan ambassador in Paraguay, an apparent mistake, and the Yugoslav ambassador in Sweden, not a mistake. So three important things to take out of this particular paragraph. First of all, again, this involvement of CAL and the World Anti-Communist League in the murder of the Yugoslav ambassador in Sweden mentioned in the article Dave just read having to do with the assassination of Olaf Palme. The involvement of Anastasio Somoza, who is now dead, but in 1980 when this was written, had just gotten to Paraguay after fleeing Nicaragua, and Somoza's involvement with helping the Croatians to fund their various bombing activities. Again, interesting because, as we mentioned on the last One Step Beyond, Olaf Palme was very heavily involved. Not only was his government among the very first to recognize the Sandinistas, they actually sent the ballots and the observers for the election that the Sandinistas held to give themselves legitimacy. So Olaf Palme has been an earlier supporter of the Sandinistas, the Contras, of course, led by Somoza's ex-National Guardsmen. Somoza, back in 1980, was in Paraguay helping to fund the Croatians, who have already killed one Yugoslavian ambassador in Sweden, and at this time had been suspected, as of that article, of perhaps being involved in the assassination of Olaf Palme.
Okay, now, remember that we're going to talk a little bit about Olaf Palme. Now, remember the Ustashi link, apparent link, at least according to the TT, the National Police Agency of Sweden, to the assassination, and the links in turn of the World Anti-Communist League, and in particular the CAL group that we began the evening talking about, to the Croatian fascists, and in turn their links to the other death squads that we've spoken about, and the Central American connection that Nip just described. About Olaf Palme, the San Francisco Chronicle described his political background in an article that they carried on Saturday, March 1st of 1986. The article is called Energetic Humanitarian, Death of Sweden's Dominant Politician by Karen DeYoung of the Washington Post at Stateline, London. Many of Olaf Palme's supporters considered him Sweden's gift to the world, unquote, the man who personified the image he wanted to give his country as a neutral, humanitarian, and caring nation. There were occasional doubts about his role at home, his sometimes apparently low level of interest in more lackluster domestic issues, and his ability to deal with them as Sweden's prime minister for nearly a dozen years. Contentious and acid-tongued, quick-witted and endlessly energetic, Palme often seemed to make up for failing internal policies with fancy footwork and a talent for fascinating an electoral majority while driving the opposition minority to near distraction. While serving as prime minister from 1969 to 1976, he presided over the expansion of Sweden as a folkhemmet, unquote, the people's home, a society based on values such as social justice, security, and solidarity that also established the biggest public sector in the Western world. Skipping down into the article, Palme is less likely to be remembered by his own people less for what he did inside Sweden than for a style of leadership and promotion of global causes that made him a prominent international figure far beyond his country's shores. From his outspoken denunciations of U.S. policy, first in Vietnam and later in Central America, to the promotion of world disarmament and a redistribution of global wealth, Palme was a statesman of the moderate left. And skipping down still further, to his opposition at home, Palme said he was known as the Jane Fonda of Swedish politics, unquote. Abroad, he was sometimes called worse than that. The United States administration was livid when he marched alongside the North Vietnamese ambassador in a 1968 parade in Stockholm. When he publicly denounced the 1972 American bombing of North Vietnam, Washington recalled its ambassador and relations went into a two-year deep freeze. He could inspire his followers with visions of socialist life, but he also had a hectoring manner that many people took for condescension. "I was born in the upper class, but I belong to the labor movement," Palme once said. "I got there by working for the working class on its own terms, by joining the movement working for freedom, equality, and fraternity among people." But also add a piece of Palme's background not mentioned here. Palme had been very, very active in lobbying for Scandinavia to be a nuclear-free zone and from the banning of all nuclear weapons from that country and that part of the world. Of course, Sweden is a member of NATO. That his opposition to America's Central American policy, the role of Sweden in the Sandinista elections, and obviously this criticism of Vietnam and his general attitude as a moderate socialist, obviously none of that is going to sit well with the U.S. intelligence and national security establishment. Worth noting also that the Ustashi maintained active links with that very same U.S. intelligence establishment. Connections on that, we're not going to read them this evening, aside from the connections through the World Anti-Communist League, in a book that we've used before on Radio Free America called Wanted, the Search for Nazis in America by Howard Blum.